30 years ago, on January 17, 1991, the world was glued to their TVs as reporters in Baghdad showed images of anti-aircraft fire and reported on bombs exploding around the city. The world was watching the initiation of the most successful air campaign in the history of warfare. On this episode, I'm joined by Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Chris Gentry, and we're talking Operation Desert Storm on the Air-Minded Podcast. This is the Air-Minded Podcast. Welcome, listeners, to the first in a three-episode arc on the 30th anniversary of Operation Desert Storm. Today, I'm joined by one of my closest friends, Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Chris Slam Gentry, and we talk about all things Desert Storm, the context around it, the build-up, the execution of the conflict, and maybe most importantly, the legacy of the Desert Storm air campaign. Slam and I got started talking, and we simply didn't stop. We were scheduled for an hour and went about two. So I decided to split this overview episode into two episodes. So this first episode, while I cover the context around the conflict, some of the key players in the air campaign, and also the development of the air campaign plan, while the second episode will cover the actual conflict, some of the major events that happened and the lessons learned, what went right, what went wrong in the conflict. The third episode of this Desert Storm 30 series I'll release next week. I'll be joined by Rick Cluso-Tellini. He's an F-15C pilot who was the weapons officer for the 58th Tactical Fighter Squadron, which was the top-scoring air-to-air unit of the war with 16 kills. We had a long conversation, again, went well beyond how long I thought it would be, where we talk a lot about the fight for air superiority over Iraq, about his own MiG-25 Foxback kill, which is a great story, and also what we can and should learn from Desert Storm and the enduring legacy or importance of air superiority. I really enjoyed that conversation. I think you will as well, so I hope you don't miss it. So back to this episode, just a couple of notes before I get to my interview with Slam. First off, Slam's known me for a long time. You'll hear him refer to me as both Getter and Gorilla. Getter is my original tactical call sign. It was changed in the great call sign purge of 2014, which is a story for a whole nother podcast, but don't get confused, they're both me. Additionally, you'll hear a fairly large cat early in our interview. Eventually, Slam took the cat out, so try not to be distracted by that. As I listened back to it, there's a couple of times we used some acronyms. We tried really hard to minimize the use of acronyms, but all of them that we use at some point are defined or spelled out, so shouldn't be too distracting. We made a couple of misspeaks, and instead of making awkward cuts and trying to get rid of it or dub over it, I just left them there. In the course of speaking for over 2 hours, you're going to make some misspeaks, so I hope you overlook those. And I do have to tell you, we dropped the occasional S word. Sorry about that, but I don't think it's too bad. We knew we couldn't cover it all, so we tried to talk about what we thought was important with Desert Storm, some of the details, really the lessons that we think are really important to take out of this. And so I'll tell you again at the end, I really hope that we hear from you on some of the things that maybe we missed, but let's get on to it. I hope you enjoyed the discussion I had with Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Chris Slam Gentry. All right, welcome, listeners. This is going to be the overview of Desert Storm episode. We are celebrating the 30th anniversary of the kickoff of Desert Storm, which was on January 17th of 1991. This is kind of the table setter episode. We'll explain some of the major things that happened around Desert Storm and some of the things that we think are important. My guest today is Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Chris Slam Gentry. He's actually Air National Guard, 2003 graduate of the U.S. Air Force Weapons School, two-time squadron commander, now living the tough life in Rhode Island at Naval War College. Slam, welcome. Thank you for joining me.
Getter, or excuse me, Gorilla. It's great to be here, dude. And really privileged and honored to get to talk about my favorite campaign to discuss, and that is Desert Storm, where I think the zenith of air power in U.S. military history.
That was already a question I was going to have for you, but let's start with the traditional first question. What are you drinking today? I will tell you, I had an interview with a MiG killer last night, so I brought out the Johnny Walker Blue, so I'm taking it a little bit easier. I've just got a Shinerbach here today for me.
Well, first off, going from a MiG killer to a Slam Gentry is one of the ultimate step downs in podcast history, but I am drinking a Whaler's Rise Rhode Island American Pale Ale, which is absolutely delightful, brewed about 20 miles away in Wakefield, Rhode Island. And for the first time since I've been Rhode Island, I'm drinking out of my 19th Weapons Squadron mug as well.
Nice. So Slam was my first weapons officer. He knew the young second lieutenant, Tyson Wetzel, and dare I say, got me moving in the right direction. I would like to think that way. You also are responsible in some small way for this podcast and my interest in air power history. And I think I've told you this story when I was, still maybe a second lieutenant. My weapons officer, when end of year funds came around, said, "Hey, we've got $500. I want you to make the weapon shop into a library, or put a library in here, and you need to buy some air power books," to which I had absolutely no idea, had read no air power books that I could think of, maybe Jaeger's book. And I called you and said, "What do I need to start this library?" I don't even think there was Amazon at the time. I actually had to go to a Barnes and Noble and buy books. It was crazy. I remember Thud Ridge was one of the ones that you gave me to read, and started me off on this process of reading many, many books. I think we're both now total air power and air history nuts. So thank you for that. Thank you for getting me started.
Yeah, well, you're exponentially more intelligent than me. So I read about a book a month. You read about a book a week. But I'm glad that I was there at that point in your career, because, dude, air power is about as good as it gets in terms of reading material or any sort of a study topic.
And so last night I was talking to Clouseau Tolini, who was the 58th Tactical Fighter Squadron weapons officer in Desert Storm, has a MiG-25 kill, and he talked about a particular moment in his career, actually, at Kadena that was really influential on him and a group of pilots at the time. And it was just a culture that was built by the leaders. It was it was kind of work hard, play hard as well. And as he was talking, it just felt a lot like the early to mid 2000s Eglin Air Force Base that we had, where you had just a ton of talent at really all levels, at all combat capabilities, and I just think we were there at a very special time. And now it is awesome to be able to kind of leverage that network and be able to talk to some of these folks on this podcast.
Yeah, no question. And the likes of our wing weapons officer and my weapons school classmate Deke Abba are, and
Brigadier really, General Deke now. Yes, can't even call him Deke anymore.
I can't call him Deke anymore. And now Colonel retired Ronald Ernie Banks is doing amazing things in the cyber realm, who was the operations support squadron commander. For those not familiar, they really have administrative and, to a certain extent, operational control of the intelligence function. And he really facilitated and created an environment where the intel guys really could work hard, play hard, and could integrate into air superior operations to the extent that I think we did.
Well, we could spend a whole podcast just talking about our days at Eglin. I think that would be my worst listened to podcast, because it would be interesting to you, me, and about two other people. So let's go ahead and talk Desert Storm. But my second traditional question that I ask all my guests is your Air Force origin story. How did you end up in the Air Force, and what brings you to today?
Yeah, Gorilla. Both my grandfathers served in the U.S. Army during the Second World War. That's the extent of my family's service. I was interested in military history and air power. I didn't know which service I would go to, and that's where really Desert Storm was really pivotal in my life. I was 13 years old during Desert Storm, and I remember exactly where I was in a vehicle coming home from a sports practice. And
I remember exactly where I was. I was at home helping my mom set up for a bunko night, which...
That could be another poorly listened to podcast as well.
But I think it's crazy that, yeah. I mean, that's in terms of moments that I remember, you know, Challenger, there are just a few moments that you really remember as a young guy. I think I'm only a year or two younger than you are. Yep. And I remember exactly where I was on what was January 16th for us, as everybody was tuned to CNN and watching Wolf Blitzer and everything that happened on that first night.
Yeah, absolutely. That first night, and quite frankly, every day when I got out of school, I was a football player, and I did track. I did nothing in the wintertime than lift weights. So I didn't lift for that 6-week period. I came home and basically watched CNN following the campaign, Wolf Blitzer, what do you got for me, every single day. So that experience is what vectored me towards the Air Force. And my father, that was his preference in terms of, once I decided I wanted to go into military, like a lot of parents do, pushed me towards the Air Force. So it was really a pretty easy decision. And then in ROTC at The Ohio State University is where I read Richard Hellion's book, Storm Over Iraq. And that book helped me understand. I was not the dude who had like four posters of fighter jets on my room growing up. I wasn't the ultimate aviation guy as a kid. And that book helped me understand not just the Desert Storm campaign, but air power, the development of fourth generation fighters in America. And I think that whole process had a great deal to do, not just with us beating the crap out of the Iraqis, but that whole process had a lot to do with the collapse of the Soviet Union and their efforts to keep up with American industrial and military industrial might during that period. So that book, which if anyone listening to this podcast hasn't read, that is a must read for understanding Desert Storm, Halion Storm over Iraq. In 1998, and I'm going to talk way more about my early career and not so much about my late. In 1998, I was an intern at the Pentagon, and being an intern in 1998 in DC, a lot of jokes there, but that's for another story, at the Pentagon. And my first day there, a lieutenant colonel named Brian Kelly, not the Notre Dame head coach getter, but Lieutenant Colonel Brian Kelly said, hey, next week, we're going to go see a one day presentation from Colonel retired John Warden. You know who that is? I'm like, who doesn't? No, I didn't. So he said, okay, you need to read the air campaign, which I did over the next couple of days, or the precursor to his book is basically his Air University thesis and study. And I read that and went and for a whole day as a 21-year-old got to listen to John Warden discuss his five rings theory, the first 4 hours in a military context, the next four actually applying it to the private sector, which was absolutely fantastic. And then in tech school at Goodfellow Air Force Base, where I read Every Man a Tiger and really learned to understand the Air Operations Center. And that's where I got a strong command of the importance of Goldwater Nichols, of the warfighting operational commands and how the service or functional components actually fit into the warfighting commands. And really start to understand the unified command structure. So those three books and this campaign had the biggest influence in my early career. And the last two things I'll say, my first two assignments were at the 352nd Special Operations Group, which had the 21st Special Operations Squadron, which is a Pavlo squadron. That squadron had alumni from the 20th, including some of the enlisted crew dogs who had been on the Task Force Normandy operation, night
possible
one,
foreshadowing. We will be talking about that.
Going to that, yeah. Thank God. That was my one requirement for coming on here. And then the, in addition to that experience, assignment number two was at the 33rd Fighter Wing, the glorious 33rd Fighter Wing, and we know the extent to the 33rd had on that campaign with all the MiG kills that I know this podcast has already started to chronicle.
Awesome. So you did get into some of the books. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Let's get into it. We've got a pretty tough job to try and describe Desert Storm. So there's a couple of things I would say up front to our listeners is neither Slam nor I are historians, and we don't claim to be. We both just have read a lot of books. We've talked to some of the people who were there, and we've kind of built our own thoughts about this air campaign, and we'll talk about it a little bit at the end. I think there has been a little bit of revisionist history in looking at this campaign, so I think it's important to talk about, do we overvalue Desert Storm and what happened? Did we take the wrong lessons learned? Or maybe have we swung the other way, and now we are giving too little credit to what happened and not taking the right lessons learned? So that's kind of big picture. In terms of how I wanted to break out this particular podcast is we're going to do three sections. One was sources, a little bit of context, Desert Shield, the run-up to the actual employment on the 17th and starting Desert Storm. Part two, I wanted to talk about the critical players. I think it's important to talk about the names that we're going to hear throughout so that everybody knows and understands. And we're not going to get into a ton of them, the big players in the air campaign. And then, but what's also really important is the development of the Desert Storm air campaign. So once we talk about those individuals, how they played a role in developing the air campaign plan. And then finally, part three, we'll be talking about the war. And there's a lot there. We've just picked a few things to talk about. And I know we're going to be missing things. Please hit me up with any feedback of things that you think we should have covered. But we will try to hit some of the things that we think are pretty important. So let's start with our part one, the sources, the context, and Desert Shield. So I had written my books that I thought were really important. Of course, Storm Over Iraq is, I think, the textbook that you need to read to understand this campaign. It actually came out in 92 and it was supported by the Air Force. So there's a lot of really good statistics. And if you just want big picture overview, I think that's a good place to start. It also gives you a roadmap on things you want to learn more about. So if you're interested in, as an example, Task Force Normandy and those initial strikes, well then, you know, go read a little bit more about that. One of the things that I'm really interested in talking about is the development of the plan. And there are two books that I think are, they kind of need to be read in tandem. The first one is John Warden and the Renaissance of American Air Power by John Andreas Olson. And then on the other side, Every Man a Tiger by Tom Clancy with General Chuck Horner. I think those look at the two different perspectives. And we're going to talk about in the plan how there's a sort of Warden faction and a Horner faction. And I don't think you can really take either sort of, I don't want to say it their word, but you need to read, I think, both of those books as kind of companion pieces. Slammer, you already told us a little bit, so you're with me on Halyan's Storm Over Iraq. Of course, Air Campaign came out in 1988 by John Warden. That's one that you brought up. What do you have? Any other books that you think really we need to, that the listeners might want to read to learn more about Desert Storm?
One thing I'll highlight for any of the perhaps that maybe the younger listeners or maybe young officers or military personnel that are listening in is even almost now 33 years after the air campaign was first written, if you want to understand combat air power, that is still, I think, the best foundational reading. Before you go on into the some of the modern technological developments, John Warden's masterpiece is, I think, an essential starting point. It's still something I recommend to young officers I interact with to this day. So I would highlight that. And I think it's pretty important to emphasize the impact that his Five Rings theory had on strategic air power and ultimately on how a lot of people began to understand how air power could have a decisive effect in winning wars and influencing campaigns as it did through much of the 1990s.
So since we've brought it up, I'm sure many of the people, if you're listening to this podcast, are probably familiar with the Five Rings theory, but we might as well talk about it right now since we've brought up Warden a couple of times, and we'll get back into it when we talk a little bit about the plan, because the plan was in large part developed on the Five Rings theory. But why don't you, Slammer, you want to talk about the Five Rings? I mean, they themselves are leadership, organic or system essentials, infrastructure, population, and fielded forces. But what is Warden saying about those five rings? What are we supposed to take from that?
I think the most important takeaway is where in most of military history for millennia, we thought about military campaigns in a linear way, that there will be a linear progression that ground or maritime forces will make, moving towards an objective and potentially a center of gravity in order to achieve victory. The air campaign's principal thesis is that we can strike a variety of strategic objectives and the center of gravity more or less simultaneously, both synchronized and sequenced to achieve a victory with minimal loss of blood and treasure in a much more expeditious fashion. And that's what I think his lasting legacy is.
And I think what's really important is we were really in the, I think, a period of air power theory stasis that started when Strategic Air Command became, you know, the primacy of Strategic Air Command, everything became about getting the bomber through and getting the nuclear weapons through. And when you have that, there wasn't a whole lot of thought about how you win conventional conflicts. And there really, air power theory did not seem to advance much until really, I think Warden is the one that really broke us out of that stasis. And I think he has, and I think we're sort of both given up where we fall on the great Warden versus Horner debate, but I think Warden puts his fingerprint on this campaign based off of the Five Rings theory. So we've talked about the sources, and I'll put them in the podcast notes. I think all of those are really important, and I think we said they're all important, but the two most important, I think, would be Halyan's Storm Over Iraq and the War Campaign, or excuse me, Air Campaign by John Warden. So the context, I think most people know, and there's going to be a bunch of shows and movies and things on Desert Storm 30. So most people understand some of the main things that happened. Iraq invaded Kuwait on the 2nd of August of 1990. famously, George H.W. Bush said this aggression will not stand. And he ordered our force to deter future Iraqi aggression into the oil fields of Iraq and to plan a possible use of force to expel the Iraqi forces from Kuwait. So a couple of things happened. Build up the coalition, sent some envoys to critical Arab nations, including most substantially Saudi Arabia, to start building a coalition. And then we started sending our forces, and we'll get into Desert Shield in a second. But I wanted to talk the Iraqi strategy and what they wanted to do with the war. Once it became clear that we were building up and we were potentially going to go to war, Saddam Hussein, he made some bad choices later, but not really an idiot in terms of his development of big picture strategy. He looked a lot at the U.S. experience in Vietnam and thought if he could withstand the air campaign and make the ground campaign as bloody as possible and turn it into a war of attrition, perhaps he could turn public opinion against the war and turn out victorious, or make the war so costly that it wasn't something that we wanted to wage long term. Overall, not a bad strategy. I don't know what you think about that, Slam.
Yeah, no, I remember distinctly the narrative in the American media at the time was, looking at the Iraqi armed forces and the strength of it, that we were setting ourselves up for another Vietnam, right? So perhaps Desert Storm's greatest legacy is it took our country out of its Vietnam syndrome, right? That we were still in that at this point. We're 17 years and change after the fall of Saigon. And that was really perhaps its greatest legacy as we look back in hindsight. But understanding that was the American media and pop culture mindset, it's certainly understandable how Saddam and his senior military leaders could have had a similar sort of mindset going into the campaign.
So let's talk about Desert Shield, and then I'm going to hand it over to you to talk about what the Iraqi threat was. So Desert Shield was the buildup of forces initially really to stop further aggression. There was a very real thought that the Iraqis would just continue on to the oil fields of Saudi Arabia and put a stranglehold on the world's oil market and cause significant upheaval. And the first aircraft that were sent out was a squadron, 24 Eagles from Langley Air Force Base, left on the 6th. They flew 15 hours straight, 7 air-to-air refuelings, fully loaded. Talking to some of the guys that flew it, they didn't know if they would be flying directly into combat. But that was our response, was we are going to have aircraft there and we are going to prevent you. We're going to give you a moment of pause and make sure you don't go to the oil fields. And once the immediate threat of invasion passed and we started to build up, eventually we got to 2,600 approximately coalition aircraft deployed primarily to the Gulf, but also to Turkey. About 2,000 U.S. aircraft, nearly 500 of those carrier-based, a massive, massive force. One of the lessons learned I think we can take out of this is never, you know, always try to overmatch the enemy. And maybe it's something that we should have heeded a little bit in 2003, but that's a whole nother podcast, and we're going to totally avoid that one. So, Slam, one of the things that I have found frustrating is sort of the revisionist history of we were beaten up on kind of the slow kid, if you will, and that the Iraqis, and I think maybe some people see how easy it was in 2003, they didn't fly, et cetera. But going into January of 91, what was Iraq facing off with us, or what were they bringing to the fight, and what did we think about their military?
Well, 2003 and 1991 are apples and oranges. Having been a vet of the 03 campaign, the Iraqis, depending who you believe, fired either 0 or 1 radar-guided SAM shot, and I believe no radar-directed AAA in 2003. That was not at all the case in 1991, not to mention that they have the fourth largest army in the world at the time, a massive force. Admittedly, Kuwait, not much of a military power, but very efficiently and professionally took control in Kuwait with that force. They had just come out of an 8-year campaign fighting the Iranians, a relatively capable military force. So they all had that recent experience. And I think very noteworthy is that both sides in that campaign used chemical weapons. And that was a big sort of underlying narrative. Of course, George H.W. Bush had sort of implicitly threatened to turn Baghdad into a glass parking lot if chems were used on American forces. But that was a really important undertone to the whole campaign. In terms of the Iraqi air defenses, as I suspect many of the listeners know, they had the French-built Qari IAD system, kind of the prototypical framework with a dedicated national air defense command center, sector operation centers, and subordinate intercept operation centers. Actually, in 2003, I had the pleasure of roaming around the Kirkuk SOC after we had overrun Kirkuk in the north. And it's really interesting to see all of the command and control nodes going into to that force. I'll come back to the quote-unquote weakling argument in just a second. The coalition lost 55 aircraft in that campaign, while a relatively small number by 20th century standards, that's still a massive number by 21st century standards. And that's something I think we should be mindful of in terms of the losses we took. So the Iraqis brought a formidable force, a large force. I think the two big points I would leave you with, Gitter, on this particular issue. One, we were preparing for 45 years to fight the Soviet Union. As an Ohio State Buckeye fan whose team just got spanked by Alabama, it's like you're preparing to fight Alabama for 45 years. You show up, and perhaps it's this year's USC team.
Going to go with Central Michigan. Come on. Right, we'll Miami of Ohio, Michigan. Something.
I'm trying to give the Iraqis a little bit of credit here. They've got some weapons. They can do some damage here and there. So while I want to give the Iraqis some respect, also we need to be mindful that the U.S. and its closest allies was preparing to fight the Soviet Union for 45 years. They show up on game day, and Saddam's forces at that point really weren't a competitive match for the U.S. and its coalition.
But it wasn't a sure thing. I mean, and that's, you know, so last night I talked to Clouseau, Tolini. It was a weapons officer getting a squadron ready. They were planning to fight MiG-29s, frontline Soviet fighter at the time, MiG-25s, MiG-23s, the French F-1, thousands of radar-directed pieces of AAA, SAMs, surface-to-air missiles, SA-2s, 3s, 6s, 8s, and then over 10,000 manned portable air defense systems. So making the threat regime incredibly dense and dangerous down low. According to Halyan, that Baghdad was 7 times more well defended. I'm not sure I said that grammatically correct. Than Hanoi was during linebacker 1 and linebacker 2. So I think when we look at it and we backtrack, or we look back and we say that it was a relatively easy air campaign, I think that should the lesson we should take out of it is because it was well planned, it was well executed, and we won the ideas. It wasn't just the equipment. We had a better game plan. We had better tactics. We had better training. And that the lesson is that's what you should do. It is not we over-prepared or anything like that. I'm sure you would agree.
I would agree. And if I didn't do justice to the threat regime, thank you for that, Gorilla. But I would also emphasize, I think it emphasized the importance and the value of U.S. doctrine of decentralized execution, and really showed the inadequacy of the really centralized control, centralized execution that was part of Soviet doctrine and to a large extent still part of Russian doctrine to this day that I think the Iraqis fell victim to.
All right. With that said, I hope that we have beaten down the argument that we were beating up on a weakling. I think that is the kind of poor revisionist history that makes us take the wrong lessons out of that. So with that said, I think we should transition into part 2, the key players. And then one of my favorite things to talk about is the development of the war plan and Instant Thunder. And we'll get into that. All right. In section 2, we're going to talk the key players of the air campaign and how the plan for the Desert Storm air campaign claimed to be. Slam, why don't you start us off? Who were the major players in the Desert Storm air campaign?
I think we got to start with Lieutenant General Charles Horner. So the commander of 9th Air Force and CENTAF at the time, most recently a Viper pilot, obviously in his career, previously an F-4 pilot. And Charles Horner, again, really for all intents and purposes, the first commander of the functional air component in modern U.S. Central Command history, technically the second, but really the first to ever see action in wartime. His interaction with Warden is famous, and one of the most famous interactions in all of air power history. That is one of the most marvelous theoretical sort of debates that will carry on forever. And it's magnificent because there's no right or wrong answer. Of course, he is working for General Norman Schwarzkopf as a central command commander. A West Point grad, very decorated Vietnam veteran, as Horner was, spoke three languages, and the dynamic between Schwarzkopf and Horner was really fascinating. And up until the start of the war, it was really a debate in CENTCOM and the component circles as to what extent the air campaign would play and when the ground campaign would start. I would submit to you that General Schwarzkopf did not necessarily have confidence that the air campaign was going to be as successful as it was, given the robust Iraqi threat that we talked about, until the events played out. The Air Operations Center, the ATO cycle, the Air Tasking Order cycle, a lot of things we take for granted as sort of meat and potatoes air operations things today, and we have for the last 30 years. I think we have to give credit to Chuck Horner for instituting and executing so effectively during Desert Storm. Had that not been so successful, I think the Air Force would have gone into another theoretical and doctrinal crisis after the campaign.
So a couple of things that before we get into anybody else, sometimes Schwarzkopf gets characterized or caricaturized by like his Chris Farley, or Chris Farley playing him on SNL. He was actually a big thinker, very cerebral. And I think what you're hitting at was he was a pretty great combined force commander, especially in the way that he was allowing Horner to have to lead the air campaign. And he maybe looked at it from a conservative, you know, didn't buy everything that Horner was saying on the timelines that Horner was telling him, but also wasn't micromanaging the air campaign. And I think when you were looking at the right way to do a unified command, you know, having one guy or gal at the top is important, but that individual needs to trust their experts. And to me, it seems like, in all the reading I've done, is Schwarzkopf did a pretty good job of giving Horner the control of the air domain. And really, he will get into it a little bit later when they determine when it's time to start going into the ground campaign. But a good conversation was going on between the two of them, really good coordination and cooperation between the two.
I couldn't agree more. And I think it's important to emphasize we are roughly 40 years after the passage of the Goldwater-Nichols Act, which reorganized how the United States organized itself for war. And it was really the first time we'd fought a major theater campaign under that construct. We had had Operation Just Cause in Panama in 1989 for U.S. Southern Command, but this was the first time really putting Goldwater-Nichols to the test. And I think by most measures, it was a rousing success.
Somebody just called out bingo, Desert Storm bingo, by getting Goldwater-Nichols. So awesome. Well, let's hear about Buster Glosson.
As a ROTC guy, I'm a big fan of retired Lieutenant General Cleveland Buster Glosson. He is an NC State Wolfpack ROTC grad and really a pilot's or an operator's commander. So had been tactical much of his career, had commanded two tactical fighter wings, and had relatively little staff time by staff officer standards when he went into his plans job preparing for the war, ultimately at 9th Air Force. Had been at 14th Air Force, the old 14th Air Force previously, and went into the Gulf campaign really as, again, the director of plans and really in charge of finding a way to build an air campaign with relatively minimal theoretical expertise. He had this sort of a savant in John Warden. He had a couple now famous action officers that he would come to rely on. But what my favorite memory of Buster Glosson, both at the time and reading back through history now, is that he had a magnificent way of appeasing the concerns of his leadership, the 3- and 4-star generals, and being the screen, if you will, and then providing the right guidance and direction to his brilliant action officer planners at the 05 level.
All right. Now, we've talked about Warden. I see him as the intellectual lead of what was going on in the Air Force. So we talk about Air Campaign, but also in 1990, Secretary of the Air Force Donald Rice put out Global Reach, Global Power. It's a phrase most of us in the Air Force are familiar with. It's on one of the walls at Langley now of one of the buildings. But it really kind of laid out what air power could do in the future. And that was ghostwritten by Warden. So we know he's there. What was Warden doing? And then what I'm really trying to get at is also his number two, Deptula. And the role that Warden and Deptula play, I see them as really the biggest Air Force thinkers of the last 30 years. And a lot of what has gone right for the Air Force, I think, is directly responsible or should be Warden and Deptula take a lot of the credit for that.
I couldn't agree more. And I think Deptula, maybe it was a result of his rank or circumstance, but he had, I believe, the right amount of pragmatism and flexibility that I'm not sure Warden had at the time. And it's a reason that Deptula was in the seat, if you will, at the kickoff in the campaign, and Warden was back in the States, quite frankly. So both brilliant thinkers, and I think they both had a necessary role to play. Warden as the strategist who wrote the Air Campaign in the 80s, Deptula as the guy working 20 hours a day for the better part of 8 months, designing and executing the Air Campaign.
So Warden, we'll just very briefly go on to kind of what the rest of their careers were. So Horner ends up becoming a 4-star, Glosson a 3-star. Warden did not actually make general officer and then ended up getting out. Deptula moved on to be a 3-star general, eventually the Air Force Director of Intelligence. As an F-15 pilot, but I still think we would agree he did a fantastic job. But I think in post-Desert Storm, he really led the thinking of employment of air power. And then eventually the Five Rings kind of becomes effects-based operations and a whole nother podcast right there. But I really think Warden and Deptula are incredibly important. And with that, I will go into the development of the Air Campaign plan, at least. So General Schwarzkopf stayed back in Tampa. He sent General Horner as his deputy, in addition to being the air component commander, sent him forward to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. And he figured Horner would be overwhelmed with his task there in working the coalition and all the things that he would have to do in Saudi Arabia. So he actually asked Headquarters Air Force and the Chief of Staff of the Air Force at the time, Michael Dugan, for help with the development of the Strategic Air Campaign. And he went to his planning directorate and asked them to help out with the development of the plan. And that's how it went to kind of the Air Force's think tank, or now they call themselves the think and do tank, Checkmate. God, I almost blanked on that. So Checkmate was being led at the time by Colonel John Warden. Now, we'll see. Horner gets very pissed about what he feels like is micromanagement or running of any part of the air war, the development of the plan from DC. His background, like a lot of these guys, was in Vietnam. And one of the things Horner hated about Vietnam was the micromanagement of the air war from DC. So he had immediate antibodies to anybody in DC working a plan. But Warden, as the big thinker for the Air Force, developed a plan that was called Instant Thunder. And just the name of it should tell you a little bit about what the plan was, as almost diametrically opposed to what we had at the beginning of Vietnam, which was Rolling Thunder, the gradual application of air power to try and get an effect out of the North Vietnamese. That is not at all what Warden wanted. What he wanted was to attack, like you mentioned, simultaneously and synchronous attacks on the five rings, the leadership, the system essentials, infrastructure, population, and the fielded forces. And he came up with a pretty revolutionary air campaign to leverage the decisive effects of air power with those attacks on what has gone back to Clausewitz as the centers of gravity, or the most important area of what the adversary does. And he wanted to leverage all the things that had happened in the post-Vietnam era to Desert Storm. So the new equipment, stealth, precision-guided munitions, the fighter modernization that we'll talk about a little bit later, also the improvement in tactics training doctrine. And Warden and Deptula built a rapid effects-based strategic air campaign that was designed to cut off the Iraqi leadership, to make their shooters basically isolated so that they could be destroyed without the effects of the entire integrated air defense system. General Schwarzkopf, when he got briefed the plan in DC in the 10th of August, so this is a week after basically the invasion, his quote is, "Shit, I love it," which I think is fantastic. And that really that tells you a little bit about Storm and Norman. So they go to so Warden and Deptula and a couple of the other guys go to Riyadh to brief the plan to Horner, and Horner and Warden just do not hit it off, and it goes really poorly. And there's two descriptions of it that are kind of diametrically opposed when you read the two books that we mentioned, Olson's book and also Clancy's Every Man a Tiger. But the bottom line is that that Horner sent Warden home, said, "Thank you, we'll take the plan from here," but did keep Deptula, which is incredibly important, put Deptula under Glossin as a primary planner in the Black Hole. And this is kind of the start of the big question of who do we credit with the war plan. And I think you have to give Warden a lot of credit. First off, he went back and at checkmate, they were kind of reach back support for Riyadh, and Deptula kind of burned up the phones and talking to Warden and the team back at checkmate. But the campaign that is executed in January looks a lot like what we see from Instant Thunder. So Horner, when he's talking to Clancy, is loath to give credit to Warden, but he doesn't really come to grips with the fact that the plan looks almost identical to Instant Thunder. So he takes some of the plan, gives it to Glossin, and says, "Turn this into an air tasking order." So I'll ask you where you fall in the great debate. I'm sure you're a Wardenite like I am, but anything that I miss in the development of this critical air campaign?
Now, in terms of where I fall, Warden, I am an absolute apostle and disciple of Colonel Warden as a strategic thinker. And in this particular case, I can understand from his perspective that you had already briefed the 4-star combatant commander who said, "Shit, I love it." You basically think that you're just going to 3-star and saying, "Hey, sir, here's what we're going to do," because the 4-star already gave me the thumbs up. That's how he approached that engagement with Horner. That did not work out well. I think he had gone into that particular engagement thinking, okay, if I can get 90% of my plan adopted by the air component commander, I think we're off to a good start. But again, I think he let perfect get in the way of good in that particular engagement. Having said all of that, the strategy of the Desert Storm air campaign gets credited to John Warden, in my judgment, more than any other single thinker. The actual operational plan, the generation of the air tasking order, and the ATO processes, that goes to Deptula, Glossin, and Horner's AOC. But at the strategic level, I think Warden gets the credit.
Absolutely. The last thing I will say on this, the 4-phase plan was phase one, air superiority over Iraq and Kuwait, or known at the time as the Kuwaiti Theater of Operations, or KTO. Phase two was a strategic campaign versus Iraqi leadership, command and control, war making and infrastructure. Phase three was attack on Iraqi fielded forces or ground forces with the intent to attrit forces 50% before they would transition to the ground war. And phase four being support to that ground war, close air support. So those are the 4 phases. Didn't necessarily go in a synchronized order like that, as we will talk about a little bit of foreshadowing here when we get into part 3. But those first 3 phases really start to happen. They're more synchronized than they are, phased or linear, like you talked about. Well, that covers the first half of my discussion with SLAM, covering some of the critical sources that you can learn more about the air campaign, the critical players, including Lieutenant General Horner, Brigadier General Glossin, Colonel John Warden, and Lieutenant Colonel Dave Deptula. We also talked about Colonel Warden's Instant Thunder plan and how that plan morphed into what became the Desert Storm air campaign. In the second half of my interview with SLAM, we'll deep dive into the air war. We cover a bunch of critical events, what went right, some of what went wrong. We talk about the enduring legacy of Desert Storm and the lessons we can and should take from this wildly successful air campaign. Thanks for tuning in to the Air-Minded Podcast. I'm the Air-Minded Gorilla, Tyson Wetzel. I hope you'll listen to the second half of my interview with Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Chris SLAM Gentry. As a reminder, the views expressed on this podcast are my own and SLAM's. They do not reflect the official views of the Department of Defense or the United States Air Force. Be sure to subscribe or review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'd also encourage you to interact with me, especially after this episode. We know we missed some things. We probably got some things wrong. We'd love to interact with you and talk about what you found interesting about Desert Storm and maybe some things that we should have covered. You can reach me at airmindedpodcast@gmail.com or on social media. I'm at airmindedpod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Thanks again for tuning in, and see you next time on the Air Minded Podcast.